the source of light. And this nearness is usually accompanied by a strange failing of outward parts, a strange detachment from the world. In other words, the prophet, the great teacher, as Buddha later said, has gone forth into homelessness. He has gone forth into a strange universal citizenship. He moves again toward the sky and with the sky. He was naturally inclined to seek the wilderness, to go forth to pray and to meditate. And the emergencies that always led him into these courses were the same emergencies. The need in himself and his instinctive sorrow for the need in others. These things always have divided some people from the rest. And somewhere in this great early time of things, the beginning of great institutions began to take place. Pike says that the mysteries of the Greeks, Egyptians, and Romans were all derived from the mysteries of Persia and India. That these institutions were the long shadow of man's basic way of learning, and that they in turn gave birth out of themselves by division once more into two parts, preserving in the one hand the great secret organizations of the world, and on the other hand blossoming forth to become the great secular educational bodies of the world. These two divisions happened. That part of learning which turned back to the contemplation of cause became religion. That part of learning which turned to the contemplation of self became philosophy. And that part of learning which turned to the contemplation of nature became science. And these things were all just the way in which some primitive man seemed to turn his head. If he turned it one way, it was one thing. If he turned it the opposite way, it was the other. Not literally and physically his head, but his point of view, his perspective, his use of the faculties with which he had been endowed. If then we may say that there is much to indicate certain points, what do we then find as the first prerequisite of the patriarch, the prophet, the great teacher? Not just the aged one of today, but the great patriarchal figure that stands like Manu against the dark and mysterious curtain of history. The first thing that we always do, the first thing that we inevitably subconsciously visualize, is that we associate the patriarch, the prophet, the great emissary of wisdom, with age. We instinctively, in our psychological experiences, always think of the teacher self and visualize this teacher self in dream or vision as an ancient and venerable person. Now, the reason why this began in the beginning was probably much simpler than we think. It was not due to the fact that man had a particular artistry in this respect, or hit luckily upon the patriarchal figure as a symbol of authority. What actually happened was that as soon as man recovered from the first impact of survival, he began to recognize that he had to preserve the vital value of age. So the first teachers of primitive man were the elders. The rest were out hunting and working. The rest were out protecting the tribe. But when the hunter grew too old to hunt, when the mother was no longer able to bear children, when the physical activities of the struggling people could no longer be borne by the decrepitude of years, age began to reveal from itself one other value, a great value. Age remembered. Age went back. Age began to speak with the wisdom of years, of experience. age had already been through these problems many times. So even today among primitive people, when a great problem affects the tribe, the elders are called. And this is important because if they hadn't had this use, the elders would probably have been exterminated, as they are in many primitive peoples who have different types of philosophy. But suddenly it was realized that the elder was worth his keep. He was worth his keep and worth his food and worth also the admiration of his people because he spoke with the long memory, as it was called. He knew heroes then dead and could describe them to the living. He could remember the great king whom the children had never seen, but whose wonderful deeds they wanted to hear about. He could remember the seasons and the great storms of long ago, and he could remember the places where he had gone to hunt, and where certain symptoms indicated that game would be plentiful. He could tell them from long years what the clouds meant and when the rain would come. He also had all the lore of his people, and as time went on, he became the great gossip, and was only one step between gossiping and deification. It all depends on what you gossip about. When you remember the private secrets of your neighbors, it is gossip. When you remember the great secrets of life, it is wisdom. And the olds and the truths and the ones of the long remembering became gradually the symbol of man's wealth of heritage. And so against the background of our culture will be seen the shadowy forms of the great rishis, the great sages. They were, maybe they were mortals, and maybe in their own day they did not look nearly so venerable. But today they are venerable. Today they represent to us the voices of the past, as Pike calls them. The voices of the great shepherds, the voices of those who remembered the stars, the strange voices that speak with echoing tone down the corridors of time, the voices of the old ones, and their voices are rich with words of wisdom. So in the rise of things, the rishis, the saint and the sage, came to be regarded as the companion of the gods. Not only did they seem to resemble him, but he seemed to resemble them. And when they spoke, it seemed that the gods were speaking, for the greatness of years was speaking. In these days also, again, the rather simple and direct life made possible this kind of memory. And by degrees the young ones came and sat around the feet of the aged one, and from him they received the Orenda of the Iroquois, received not only the story, but the strange vitality of dedication. They were part of something. In their veins flowed the blood of the heroic past. They were the heirs to the things the elders told them. And when one by one the elders slipped away, they in turn became elders to carry on the sacred heritage. So in the circle of the old ones was the history of the people, the mystery of its faith, the story of its dreams, the account of its migrations, and perhaps most of all, the wonderful reports of the heroes, the descriptions of things, so that the old one would say, "This my father told me," and the children would sit around and listen. And in the strange process of listening, they became citizens. They became directed in their own lives. They began to see what it meant to be remembered. And each of the young ones said to himself, "I shall so live that those who come after me shall remember me among the heroes." Little by little, the virtues of the tribe were inculcated in this way. And as this body of lore became greater and greater, came with it also the skills, the crafts and the knowledges of the people. Here also were not only the historical records, but the laws and legislation moved out of the great mystery of the circle of the elders, the ancient ones of the earth, as they have been called. And from them, as from the lips of Manu, have come the laws. So in the Pike says, somewhere in the mysterious hinterland of man's thinking, there sits at the very beginning of this great Iranian-Aryan migration, this strange, mysterious circle of the ancient ones of the earth, the ones to whom it seems all knowledge must be traced. All ideas seem to originate from them. All records, all reports of old times flow through them. They are the link between man and his own origin. All the wonderful things that he wants to know and he wants to believe. Now, is it really actually a fantasy at all, or is this a sober truth? I'm inclined to think, from experiences with so-called primitive peoples, that this is actually the sober truth. This actually happened. Because I know that today I could go into a primitive society and I would find that this is the way they live. That I can find immediate evidence that at the back of their belief and at their tradition is this circle of the elders, perpetuated now by another circle of living elders, who are the visible progenitors of the ancient ones, their servants, their priests, sharing in their veneration, and venerated because they have in turn venerated. And if you want to go into a comparatively primitive society and you want to know the ways of that society and you want to understand its reason for existence, you sit with the elders and they will tell you. And they will tell you not in just prosaic language, do this and do that. They will do as ancient man did. They will sit back, they will be quiet, they will take their time according to their own pleasure, and when they have decided, they will speak with a strange tongue, for they will say also, I will tell you a story. And whether this story is the Vedas or the book of Genesis, it is still the story that has come down from the olds. And as time went along and these things became more integrated and knowledge became more pressing upon man and his own experience required more and more levels of answers, in order that he might maintain certain perspective, these circles took on a strange value. And one of the values that happened was that everyone, every time, was not permitted to come and talk with the elders. You couldn't simply knock on the door any time you want to and have the ancient ones assemble on requirement. So to speak to the elders, to know them, to be taken into their story, to sit at their feet as the disciple at the feet of his guru. This was an occasion. This was something that might not happen often. Something rare. Something you had to live for and build for. And out of this came the gradual development of the puberty rites and also the caste rites. And the rites of growth and maturity and the various tribal initiatory rites that are described so well by some of our great writers on primitive people, such as Churchwood in his Signs and Symbols of Primordial Man. These rites were a sacred drama, a sacred institution. And acceptance into them was the beginning of the life of maturity in the tribe. Until you had received these rites, you were not responsible. Until you know, it was not expected of you that you would do. But the moment you knew, you must do. Because to fail after we once possess knowledge is a grievous fault, but to fail without knowledge may only be a symbol of childishness. So when the time came for the child to become accepted into his people. He was purified, he was prepared, he was consecrated, he was tested and tried. And then, at the proper moment and with proper ceremony, he was brought to be instructed by the great teachers. These were the great teachers. He had met them all, perhaps, and played beside them in the village street. But when they gathered for this purpose, they were something else again. They were suddenly very grave and venerable people, sensing their own responsibility, the responsibility of carrying on to him the tradition that must not die. So, with proper ceremonies, he was tested, tried, and informed. And having been informed in Egypt, the child lock of hair was cut off, and his milk name was taken away from him, and his man name was given to him. And he was then expected to go out and carry his part of the burden of life, and to carry the responsibility of his people, and to be above reproach in character. Because now he had seen. Now he knew the reason for his own existence, and he knew the great and wonderful story of his people. Therefore, in pride he should walk, with his head high, proud that he was part of so great and glorious a social structure. He must defend it with his life and honor and his worldly goods, and never betray it. Thus, out of this background came the gradual rise of the great mystery institutions of India, Persia, Egypt, Greece, and the Americas. Here also came gradually from these mystery institutions, as budding from an ancient stem, secular education as we know it. Gradually the importance of arts and crafts and sciences were emphasized in man's economic survival, and education became the transmission of man's acquired skills rather than the perpetuation of man's internal insight. So for lack of insight, his skills lead him into trouble. But the ancient system placed his moral character first and his vital attainments high in this pattern. Pythagoras of Samos, in the 6th century, traveled through most parts of the known world of his own day. He visited many of the great sanctuaries of the mysteries. He learned that the Egyptian of the cult of Osiris believed that their deity in the form of a sacred bull had been driven from India, and had been brought from Asia into the temple. He learned of the indebtedness of these peoples to each other, and he also realized that if this great stream of the great Iranian-Aryan tradition did flow around the world, it flowed because of the existence of this great interrelated system of esoteric educational orders. Pythagoras discovered, and after reaching, visiting, and affiliating with more than 20 great religious groups, that in his day, this stream of tradition, moving from the East, was moving with an adequate mechanism, that this mechanism was a system of education that then prevailed, that this system of education, like tubes or pipes, channeled the great water of life, and that as late as the 2nd or 3rd century A.D., that actually the great religious centers of both East and West were in communication with each other, and that all these systems and all these channels recognized their common dependency upon one great stream of spiritual light. If this be so, and there seems much evidence to sustain it, then we can understand how this ancient river falling from the head of the gods did descend, not only into the great Indo-Gangetic plain, but through the mysteries, flowed into Egypt, Greece, Samothrace, Sparta, Eleusis, to form the great rites of the Kabiri, and many other of the Dionysian cults. Orpheus came from the East to Greece, bringing the same tradition. And the reasons, therefore, perhaps, that we find traces of one religion under the numerous and almost countless separations of sects today is that religion, in its turn, as we know it today, for the what we call religion today, really had no counterpart in the ancient world. But what we call religion today is really the opening of the doors of the ancient mystery temples and the flowing out of their teaching into a more democratic type of society. What we study in school today was once part of the mystery religion. It was the mystery religion that gave the world mathematics, that gave it art and literature, philosophy, medicine, and law. These things were all parts of the temple religions. But gradually they have flowed out into our more common way of life. But if they came from the mystery temples, and the mystery temples themselves came from a common tradition, and this tradition flowed from the northern parts of Asia, then we can easily see why some simple emblem or symbol, some statute, some name, some term we daily use now could well be traced back to this original source. It was in the light of this, of course, that Laplanjong, exploring the mysteries of the Mayas and Kichi of Central America and studying their hieroglyphics, made to him the important discovery that because he had already been a student of Egyptian hieroglyphics, he could decipher most of those of the Western Hemisphere. He may not have been entirely correct, but he did establish, beyond any doubt, hundreds of parallels, not only in the symbolic and glyph forms, but actually in the pronunciation of words, so that the word for man, or the word for sun, or the word for life, or the word for God, in the languages of the Old World and the New were identical. Thus, these streams had to have flowed from somewhere. We may want to take the idea of spontaneous generation of these ideas in isolated areas, and if we had to, we could contemplate the possibility that all men reaching a certain degree of culture would come to certain common conclusions about things. This would be suitable if we could not establish the bridges by means of which we know that in a still simpler way, the migrations of peoples and the unfoldment of learning in all of its branches would carry this knowledge, this great stream, without strange, mysterious, or psychological circumstances. It is as common as the bow and arrow migration or the swastika migration or any of the other primitive, symbolic, migratory patterns by which we have learned to measure the travelings and adventures of peoples. We know that these things could have happened. We know that almost certainly they did happen. And we know also that practically every scriptural book of the world today is indebted to those of Asia, simply because in this Asiatic pattern we seem to come upon the oldest and most clearly defined example of something. And that the motion of these peoples through time gradually resulted in their domination. And with their domination in many regions, their ancient beliefs came to permeate and dominate these regions, slowly causing older beliefs or other unrelated doctrines to be submerged. Now, when we study this a little further, we make another interesting discovery, namely, that this great cycle had about it something that was very Neoplatonic. The gods of the ancient Arya, these strange sky, earth, and altar deities that we have come to remember, did not, in those times or under those conditions, declare war upon the gods of other men. That was very much later, when things got into pretty bad shape. Actually, these great deities, like Osiris and his celebrated journey around the world, converted people with a strange tenderness. The conversion was a rather simple thing. This great interpretation accepted into itself all other interpretations, and the light of the Veda shining upon other beliefs caused these other beliefs to shine with its own light. It was simply a light cast upon all things, causing these things to resemble itself. Thus, in Egypt, for example, the old gods of Egypt, prior to contact with Asia, did not cease. They simply took on an Asiatic look. The ancient gods of the Nords, for instance, Thor, the Thunderer. the individual who seemed to spend most of his time fishing for the Midgard snake or throwing his hammer in the form of a swastika around the world, it was perhaps the oldest form of the boomerang, this deity was once the supreme deity of the Nordic pantheon. But later, when Odin, or the Teutonic Wotan, nor probably really Prince Sigi, a Scythian prince, came from Asia and came into domination in this area, he did not go to war with Thor. He did not destroy him. He did not say he was a false god. And when the great cult of Odin was set up at Uppsala in Scandinavia, Thor was invited to dinner with the rest. Thor became a member of the new family. Thor became merely an attribute. He became an embodiment of one of the characteristics of this new doctrine. So in many instances in the old legends, we hear that saints going forth, like Padmasambhava in Tibet, first of all converted all the demons, converted all the false gods, and made them all members of the true faith. It was a wonderful thing. It was done very nicely, because these deities simply became repolarized so that they became the aspects and attributes of the new principle which was taking over. Thus, in practically all of these faiths among the ancient peoples, particularly back at about that time, which we call the dark curtain of history, we see a marked change in the pattern of the divinities. The old hero gods, the gods of lesser station, the old fighters and rumblers and tumblers of the early days, sort of fade away or become associated with a newer and better spiritual perspective. They then become the obedient instruments of the new faith. They were remembered and continued to have certain honors paid to them. But they had been changed until they were compatible with the new doctrine. And wherever it went, this great stream of vitality absorbed and reinterpreted other faiths or found itself in other faiths until finally all of the conflict or inconsistency was dissolved. As a result of that, other elements are present in all religions. But the great basic elements of this tremendous tradition survive and dominated and continued. Pike, explaining his concept, makes a great use of what he considers to be one of the oldest and richest forms of nature worship. And he devotes in his writings many, many pages, including learned translations from Hebrew, Persian, even Coptic Greek, and a careful study of the available manuscripts and records of the Egyptians and of the East Indian people and the Chinese to prove very definitely the supreme importance in the psychic descent of man's great stream of faith, the supreme importance of the symbolism of the worship of fire. Now, Pike is one of the first, of course, to remind his reader that the worship of fire is entirely a symbolic ceremony. Fire was no more worshipped by fire worshippers than the sun was by sun worshippers. Always fire became associated in an early time with life. Fire was the first discovery that completely altered and changed the destiny of man. Agni, the spirit of fire, like Prometheus, was one of the first great friends of man. Fire to primitive man had a series of mystical connotations. By means of fire, it seemed that man could create life. He became a magician. He could invoke radiance out of darkness. Fire had many, many meanings to him, but perhaps its greatest and most important meaning was life. Fire was a life in his keeping, a life that he could tend. Fire was upon an altar, and he could bring his offering to it. and he could protect the fire. And the fire became the symbol of his own stewardship to eternal life. Man began to associate the extensions of the symbolism of fire with innumerable moods and attitudes of his own. Even today, we have the term very closely associated with a great many of our psychological, most subtle implications of thinking. We say that an individual is inflamed with an idea. We say that he is fired by a purpose. We refer to the rise of intellectualism in man as the blazing forth of a spark. We know also that fire was associated with heat, heat and warmth with body, and that death for man was the going away of the fire, going away of the heat, going away of the warmth. A Muslim scientist many centuries ago, attempting to determine the nature of the life in things, performed dissections or vivisections upon living animals. And at one time he placed his finger on a certain point in the pulsing heart of a living animal, and immediately his finger was blistered. He found there a point of great heat, and he became quite concerned with it and wrote considerably on the subject. But life is heat to ancient man, and the fire in man burned upon the matchless altar of his heart. The heart was the sanctuary of the flame. The flame was life. When the flame burned, man lived. When the fuel perished, man died. Buddha, in one of his discourses, goes into considerable detail in a symbolical use of fire. He explains, for example, that if every fire on earth was extinguished so that man never could see fire anywhere, and that all the storms and all the changes of nature were such that lightning would never strike, that no natural friction or reflection would ever cause a fire, so the world was without fire for 10,000 years. And then, if there be a person to do it, flint is struck against steel and fire is born again. Fire is everywhere, silently, secretly, unknown. But it must be brought into manifestation. And the manifestation of fire out of the totality of itself into the expression of itself was a mystery that ancient man greatly contemplated. He also greatly revered the purifying power of fire. How fire cleansed things, and also how fire consumed the sacrifice. He also saw how fire consumed the fuel that sustained it, and that when the fuel was gone, fire disappeared. And in modern times, man has discovered a strange kind of fire that burns without dross, as we know it. And that fire is a form, of course, of electricity. And we put that fire in a little glass bottle, and we made an electric light. And when we first made that light, what did we call it? We called it the Mazda light. We had already gone back to an ancient term for light, for brilliance, for shiningness. In the ancient Hindic people, the old gods, the Devas or Devs, meant the shiners, or the light ones. And everything that was light, everything that shone, was life. And where the flame went out, where the fire failed, things died. Then there were the fires of holy aspiration, the fire of martyrdom. Then there was a fire of zeal and of hope, and the strange blazing passion of love. There was fire of hate. And everywhere there was fire, there was heat, there was life. The primitive man gradually devised the concept of Agni as the symbol of the power of life. Fire became the visible symbol of the quality of life, life living on matter, life perpetuating itself by destroying its own not-self. Spirit flaming forth because of the fuel which it is to consume, consciousness consuming body, and perhaps, if the pessimism of Buddha is correct, dying with it, but a great blaze while still it shines. The candles upon an altar, the incense burner, the oil lamp, all these symbols, like the ever-burning lamp of the Rosy Cross, or the strange eternal lamp found in the tomb of Cicero's daughter. The lamps that burn on, the lamps with wick of asbestos, strange conjectures and chemistries and alchemies of ancient thinking, but always this problem of fire. This problem of man worshipping the flickering, variable symbol that is so alive that its body is part of its life and cannot be seen from it. The fire that can be put out by the mystery of water, and then the alchemist coming along with his strange formula which says, I shall make a fire that burns in water, and I shall make a fire which the fuel is water, and this fire shall burn forever. Now the ever-burning fire is to a measure probably, at least in one of its degrees, associated with the sun. The sun, this great incandescent light, this symbol of radiance that became warm in summer and in the desert a destroying heat. But the fire and the sun and light, these together, man identified ultimately with his own truest self, his own consciousness, so that fire and light became symbols of consciousness. For man was aware by a kind of invisible light within himself, the light of reason, the light of the mind, but most of all, the light of the soul. In the old early Rosicrucian symbolism, there is an ancient representation of Christian Rosenkreuz, the secret master of the Rosy Cross, reading a book by the light of a candle. There is some probability that the picture was originally taken from the familiar portrait of St. Jerome by Albrecht Dürer. But in any event, the point is that by the light of a candle or a lamp or a fire, man reads a book. He reads also the mysterious living book by the light of consciousness within himself. So without the fire, the mind is meaningless. Without fire, love fails. Without fire, rationality is impossible. And this fire must be the fire of awareness, the fire of consciousness within the individual. For man reads not by the light of the sun on the outside alone. By that he sees the letters. But by the light of the sun in himself he sees the meaning. And that is the great and important difference. So the sun became also the symbol of meaningfulness. It became the symbol of true cognition. And fire was the sacred part in man. And as time went on, the fire was associated with the soul. And the soul was this beautiful, radiant, flaming part with an aureole-like existence. And this soul was the light in man. And the fire and the light also came to be representative of enlightenment and of the enlightened. And under this same thought we have in our own scriptures, the mystery of the light of the world, the being that came to give light to every man or to every creature that lived. For the very word Christ from Christos simply means the fuel of the flame. It represents the mysterious oil of baptism, but this is the oil which supports the flame. And the Eucharistic ceremony, and Melchizedek with the corn, wine, and oil, establishing the sacred sacrament. The oil is the symbol of the fuel of God, which if lit turns all of man into a strange burning thing, burning with the power of the divine presence. So in the tabernacle we have the seven-branched candlestick. We have the great being of Revelation walking amidst the candlesticks with a blazing sword coming from his mouth. All these symbols go back to the old belief in fire. And fire the holy aspiration which burns all decay. Fire, the divine desire of man to be one again with truth. Fire, the symbol of his everlasting and eternal covenant with life, causes each individual to be a keeper of the flame. And this ancient man strangely comprehended, because it was fire that gave him dominion over the world. And it could only mean that this fire was the symbol of the soul. For it was only the soul in him which enabled him to take dominion. It was only because this fire lighted his life, and that another fire from within himself blazed forth, that man could be other than a brute, and could achieve or attain other things than the beast could attain. So as we say, fire became the symbol of soul. It became the symbol of a covenant. It became the living witness of the eternal before men. For it was the purest of all bodies. And into this flame, all dross, all imperfection, all human limitation, all selfishness must be cast as an offering to the Most High. So fire worship came also, strangely, from this great, strange northern region. And in the form of the god Agni, it came to have a very great and important part in the rituals of our ancient forebears. And we might mention one other for the moment. We mentioned last week, but I think we must come back to it again, and that was Varuna. And Varuna was also an ancient deity of these peoples, and Varuna was a strange, airy power. Varuna was a strange, all-pervading atmosphere that linked all things into a strange capacity. Varuna was a lord of middle regions and of parts. Varuna, in many ways, perhaps, if you study the symbolism of the deity, is reminiscent of the psychological idea of mind. Varuna is an intellectual atmosphere, a wind deity, a god of motion and of moving things, a god invisible but made visible by consequences, a deity that also went through innumerable vicissitudes, as General Pike points out. But we have here, then, sky, fire, and air. Or, as we also suggested in the other discussion that we had, there are certain parallels between Varuna and ether. Not the air as we know it, but the etheric humidity, which science has invented as a hypothetical medium between energy and matter. Thus, as Heraclitus tells us, this peculiar humidity can also be a water deity, or a deity of humidity, or a deity of fertility. And in the, as we told you last time, out of the names of these deities and out of the patterns of them, we gain the elements of the divine name in the ancient ritualistic language. But we have elements that work together in a very strange manner, because we have now actually established a trinity that corresponds to the three elements, salt, sulfur, and mercury, in the Hermetic experiment. And in the 18th degree of the Rose Croix, General Pike gives us some information on the tie between alchemy and the great Vedic mythology, showing again that at the root of chemistry, at the root of astronomy, at the root of architecture, are the parallels once more to this ancient system of thinking, and that these parallels can be restored from any study of essential symbolism in any department of human life. But we have the all-pervading, symbolized by the great two-and-a-half-syllable monosyllable. We have then also fire, and we have air, or air-water, humidity, the ether of space, perhaps the energy or electric field of modern science. These things, all working together, give us a pattern of primordials. And we have various interpretations based upon the chemistry of these original factors. Mind, for example, as the bridge, the Bifrost, between Midgard and Valhalla. Mind arises in the form of the great world hero. The great world hero passes the mystery of fire. In the case of the Sigurd saga, the world hero passes through the mystery of the four elements, represented by four great labors which he performs. This mastery by the hero of the interval, the middle distance between the worlds, is very important. Fire as soul and consciousness, air, water as mind, emotion, the psychic part again, and heaven as totality, as the reality, as the wholeness. These together create a triangle or trinity, which emerges later for our contemplation in the Brahma Vishnu Siva concept of creation, preservation, and reconstruction. Always the symbolism remains, and wherever we have a holy trinity, from the Temple of Heaven in Peking to the three-tiered hat of the Dalai Lama and the triple tiara of the Roman Pontiff, in all these we have mastery over three worlds, three elements, three conditions of being. We have man moving from the material through the psychical to the spiritual. We have the individual overcoming the world, nursing the flame, guarding it, becoming a servant of it. For one form of the flame is found in the Grail legend. For the flickering, mysterious, flaming blood in the Sun Grail is exactly the same as the ancient fire of the Vedas. It is the object of the quest. It is the sacramental symbol. It is the symbol of sacrifice and reunion, of renunciation and purification. In all these things, then, and also through our own scripture writings and into our arts and sciences, into our legal procedure, into electricity, and even into electronics, we will find the same principles that these primitive persons, or this great wave of simple, direct, true-seeing creatures or beings, brought forth out of the dawn of time and carried with them into all parts of the world. The picture is long and difficult, but I think what General Pike particularly wants us to realize, that the word Freemasonry in its original meaning from the Chaldean means child of the fire. The word pyramid represents the mountain or monument to the flame. That's what the word means. And in the ancient times of Eleusis, when the high elephant in his robes of blue and gold came forth upon the porch of the sanctuary, his gold and blue robes were the inner and outer circles of a flame with its blue center and its golden radiant core. The garments of priesthood, all of the ancient symbols that we know, are derived from the guardians, keepers, and watchers of the ancient fires. And these fires were brought from heaven by the druids, who captured the rays of the sun on a reflecting glass. And all the fires of earth are to these sacred monuments reflections of the fires that burn forever in the heavens. And these fires are the eyes of the gods. And each of these eyes and each of these fires in turn is part of the great flame of the one God that lies at the root of things. We are sparks from the flame, and to the flame we will return. This, I think, is probably all we can do this evening, so we will continue with the good general next week.